Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Sylvie Grier-Rivera, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to welcome our distinguished speaker, Dr. John Needers, to the Commonwealth Club of California for the fourth time tonight. So Dr. John Needers is the president of the third oldest acupuncture school in the U.S., the Academy of Chinese Culture and Health Science in Oakland. He also has his private clinic in Alameda and is the host of the Balancing Point radio show, a call-in show, every week. As a doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine and also Western nutrition, Dr. Needers is able to make this more than 2,000-year-old medical tradition relevant to our own modern lives. And he is also a good guide through the integration of these systems to attain optimal health and balance. For this audience, he has previously addressed this very idea of an integrative medicine. He has addressed the topic of food as medicine and also brain health and dementia. And tonight, he will tackle yet again another heated subject, gluten. As a French person, as you may have noticed, who cannot conceive the idea of not eating bread with every meal, I'm dying to hear what Dr. Needers has to share on this subject and also on what makes a healthy diet. And since there's never enough time to hear what Dr. Needers has to say, I will leave the mic to him now. So without further ado, please welcome Dr. John Needers.
Thank you very much. That was a very sweet welcome. And I want to thank you all for coming out and spending an hour with me. Again, that's quite an honor. Being in the Bay Area, we have a lot of choices. And I'm always honored to speak here because the audiences always ask great, great questions. So let's move into our topic here. And I'm going to get to Sylvie's question toward the end, actually, about being French and eating wheat and why that was very different for her growing up than what she's eating now. So maybe we'll scare her a little bit. But the first thing I'm noticing, one of the things that I'm going to talk about today is a book called Grain Brain. And in that, Dr. Perlmutter does a very superb job of elucidating the problems of grain and eating grain, and wheat in particular, in concerning dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And I'm particularly worried because I forgot that I did the dementia talk here until she mentioned it. So anyway, we'll see. So the question, you know, it comes up a lot. Wheat allergies, sensitivities, is this a fad? Is this fiction? You know, what is this stuff, right? Because there's always some new nutritional thing. Don't eat fat. Eat fat. Eat grains. Don't eat grains, right? And the food pyramid changes, and now it's a plate. And it's completely different than it was 10 years ago. Now, one of the wonderful things about Chinese medicine is that it doesn't change, right? What they were talking about 2,500 years ago, in general, is still relevant today. One of the areas where it's not as relevant, actually, is nutrition. Because when they speak, when I teach Chinese nutrition, I always have to put the caveat in that this is generally accurate. However, the food that we're eating, it has very little similarity to the food that they were eating 2,500 years ago in China. Chicken, dairy, it's completely different. So that's one of the things we're going to look at tonight. So we're going to look at how these systems fit together, our agenda. I'm going to look at why this vilification of wheat, you know, why is everybody so hostile? Poor wheat. And I'm going to look at some of the differences between allergies and sensitivities and the variety of issues that can arise with wheat, and then give you the Chinese medical view on gluten and what's changed. So just a real quick outline of Chinese medicine, about 2 or 3 minutes for some of you that aren't very familiar. it's the oldest continuously practiced form of professional medicine, so not a folk medicine. They had colleges of Chinese medicine for hundreds and hundreds of years. Very difficult to get into, harder than our medical schools here even. I mean, it was very difficult, the exam. So it's a very old profession. It goes back to the Huangdi Neijing, which is the Yellow Emperor's classic, which is still very accurate. I'll have people come in often, my patients, and say, well, you know, I've got all these books that I could read about healthy lifestyle. You know, and one says one thing and one read says something else. You know, I'm supposed to get 15 minutes of exercise. The other one says an hour and a half. What should I read? I say, go back to the Huangdi Neijing. Everything that you're reading now that is, as we get more and more accurate of our understanding, is in the Huangdi Neijing. They had this nailed. How they did it, who knows. But 2,500 years ago, how much you should exercise, how much sun you should get, 15 minutes a day, no more, no less, right, et cetera, they nailed 2,500 years ago. So there are five branches of Chinese medicine. There's acupuncture and moxibustion, which is moxibustion is a heat therapy, but it's related to acupuncture, herbal medicine, Tuina massage, nutrition, and then exercise or energetic work, things like qigong, tai chi, etc. And there's a common misperception that biomedicine is based on science and Chinese medicine isn't. But actually, this isn't true. It's been well proven by Archie Cochran, who is the most famous epidemiologist in the world, that as practiced, you know, you go to a doctor, 20% of what they will suggest to you or do is actually proven and supported by medical science, the way it's practiced. Now, I'm not saying there's not a lot of good science out there. And on Chinese medicine, if you go on Medline, you'll find about 18,000, it was 17,676 when I looked a couple years ago, articles on acupuncture. Not just that it works, but precisely how it works. Changes in hormones, changes in neurotransmitter function, etc. Amazing work being done. And then there are over 10,000 herbal studies a year. But the real beauty is in integration. And I'm going to apologize for the slides because these look really, really good on projectors that I'm used to using, but they have too good, the equipment's too good, right? You can actually see the pixels. But this is a great book for any of you interested in Chinese medicine, just kind of an overview, or Chinese discoveries. It's called The Genius of China by Robert Temple. And some of the things that Temple shows in his book, they have the translation of a recipe for making testosterone and human growth hormone supplements 2,500 years ago. Now, this is something that's just hit big in the U.S. in the last few decades. They actually have the exact recipe. You take 150 gallons of young men's urine, you put it in a particular size cauldron, in a particular size room, and the fire has to be an exact color. And the reason for the color is, of course, that determines temperature, or it will tell you what the temperature is. And if you put a fire at that temperature, it is exactly the temperature that you need to boil off the fluid, but not damage the enzyme content of the hormones, which will be damaged at 310 degrees. So then you take the sludge that's left, you roll it up with honey and a date paste, and you give it to old men. 2,500 years ago, they were doing this. And it's much better than any hormone therapy you'll get now because it's real human hormone rather than synthetic. They had diabetes formulas in 200 AD. They were doing open cavity abdominal surgery in the first century and treating thyroid disease. How many of you have heard of David Brownstein? Okay, David Brownstein's kind of supposed to be the cutting-edge guy on thyroid treatment, you know, does really high-quality work. There was a Chinese doctor named Sun Simo who in 618 AD was doing exactly the same treatment. Okay. So pretty good stuff. But anyway, let's get back to wheat. It's so innocent, isn't it? You know, we all grew up with wheat. And then we've got this picture, the staff of life, right? Isn't wheat the staff of life? Of course it is. You know, in one of my favorite, two of my favorite, I think, History Channel shows. One was showing that in Alexandria alone in Egypt, there were 600 breweries because that was how they could get wheat and get the B vitamins and other minerals out of the wheat and store it without it rotting because the alcohol. And then there was another show that was on right after that called How Booze Saved America. So I love those shows, right? But really, we're going back to wheat as the staff of life. There are many cultures that lived primarily on wheat-based diets. So how could we have such a problem with wheat, if indeed we do? This is a fun book called Wheat Belly, and this is by William Davis, who's an MD, looking at the difference between eating a grain-based diet and a non-grain-based diet in terms of weight and weight loss. And one of the things people will often think is, well, of course, if I eat all those carbohydrates, I'm going to gain weight, right? But what's actually accurate is it's worse than that. There was a study done a few years ago, and they had people eating exactly the same number of calories per day, exactly the same number of calories for breakfast. One group ate a bagel, and I love bagels, but one group ate a bagel. The other group ate an egg, and the egg group lost 5 times more weight. Same caloric intake. So there's something going on well beyond the calories here. This book is one of my favorites, The Grain Brain, and this is the Grain Brain cookbook. If you're interested in looking into this subject further, probably the simplest and easiest and most readable way to do that is to go to Dr. Perlmutter's book, The Grain Brain. And he has some statistics that are quite startling, looking at the rates of dementia and Alzheimer's in people who are heavy grain eaters versus those that aren't. And for most of you, I recommend you don't read the book. Okay, it's going to be a little scary for you. And then we've got another book, The GAPS Diet. This is by an English doctor who had a son who was diagnosed with autism. She knew nothing about autism. She didn't have a class that they even mentioned it. So she did some very intensive research and discovered that ADHD and autism have very, very high correlations with grain-based diets, and particularly wheat. And the reasons for that we'll get to. So how far are we going to go, right? Here's 150 gluten-free recipes. So why is there so much disagreement in the medical world, right? You'll get doctors that say this wheat stuff is a fad. You get other doctors, that's what they specialize in. And the reasons are peer review bias, disagreement about definitions, looking for the wrong problem with the wrong tools, and clinical versus functional medicine. And it's all changing so rapidly that a lot of the GI docs are kind of 20, 30 years behind in understanding this. So peer review bias. So we all know the value of peer review. You submit an article, and it gets reviewed by a bunch of experts in the field. Sounds really good, and it does have a benefit. However, it's a closed box because those people are peer reviewers because they basically are peers, and they all agree on certain things. So to get a new idea into that peer review or through that peer review process can prove to be nearly impossible. So that's one of the problems. As these new studies come up and are reported upon, often they're not put in all the journals. And we're going to get to the definitions here. And the bottom line is you aren't eating your grandma's muffins. So if you're eating a muffin, it has very little to do with what you ate if you're my age, that my grandma made, or even my mom. So the wheat has been significantly hybridized. The fellow that, I don't remember his name, who developed the strain of wheat that we mostly eat now, it's a dwarf wheat, got the Nobel Prize. Now, he got the Nobel Prize basically because he found a grain that would produce at a much higher rate than other grain, than the older grains. It needed almost no nutrition. You just throw a little nitrogen on it, and it would grow almost anywhere and had a very short growing season. So this is great, right, if you want to produce and mass produce huge quantities of grain. However, in that hybridization process, they developed a grain that instead of having 14 chromosomes for gluten, I'm going to use the term gluten, it's not quite accurate, but it's good enough, the new dwarf winter wheat, or the dwarf wheat, has 28 chromosomes to make gluten. And, of course, that's really nice if you're making bread, right? How many of you bake bread ever? Okay, or been around. So you know you can take a ball of dough and stick it to the wall, right? It's that sticky. Well, one of the problems with that gluten being that sticky is it literally adheres to the lining of your small intestine. And when it adheres to the lining of the small intestine, as a protein, the body knows a protein can be dangerous. Maybe it's a bacteria. It doesn't know what this is, so it attacks it. And the longer it comes in contact with the lining of the intestine, the more inflammation you get as the body's attacking. right? That attacking process is what leads to inflammation. So any of those sticky, they're called lectin-type foods, high lectin-based foods. And so they're very sticky. Things like soybeans is the worst for the bean family. Corn is problematic, but wheat is by far the worst. So it adheres to the lining of the intestine, and the body starts to respond to it. So the more gluten in the bread, the easier it is to make bread, but also the easier it is to inflame your entire system. And because it'll grow on any soil, the plants are getting their nutrients from the soil. So now you have something that's not just not the staff of life. It's probably closer to the staff of death, right? It's really a very different product that we're dealing with. And so some potential problems. I think most everybody now has heard of celiac disease. It's, you know, it's kind of up in the mainstream now. Wheat allergies, gluten gliadin allergies, delayed immune reactions, autoimmunity. But what people don't realize is there are at least 28 known potential sensitivities, hypersensitivities, allergies, autoimmune problems that can occur from eating modern wheat. Okay, 28. And that's why it becomes so confusing. If you go to a medical doctor that doesn't specialize in this, are they looking for 28 different problems? Probably not. I've never seen a doctor look for it. This slide is really bad, so I brought this along. This is the 17th edition of Tabor's Medical Encyclopedia. It's a really important book because between the 17th edition and the 18th edition, they changed the definition of what an allergy is. Okay? And that's one of the that's why people get so confused, or one of the reasons. So in the 17th edition, which is 1993, 18th and 1997, in this edition, if I read it to you, there are four different types of if you look at the word allergy, there are four different types that they talk about. When you go to the 18th edition, only one of those types is still included as an allergy. The other three have been shuttled off to other definitions, sensitivities, delayed immune response, etc. So if you went to a doctor in 1994 and you said, and you were having a problem with wheat, and you said, I think I have a food allergy, you would have been right. If you go in 1998 and you say, I have a wheat allergy, they're going to say, you're wrong, just because they changed the terminology. So again, this creates a lot of confusion. So anyway, it's very fascinating stuff. Now, I put this up here. Please don't get stressed about this. But I put this up because along the left side, you'll see these, IgG, IgM, IgD, IgA, IgE. These are all different immunoglobulins. And immunoglobulins are essentially messengers. So like immunoglobulin G up here at the top, if you get infected with something, something enters your tissues, and the body wants to respond to it, what it does is it sends out this is really grossly simplistic, sends out immunoglobulin G that marks it. And then these giant cells called macrophage means big eater, they come along and they eat the marked antigen, this thing that you're allergic to or the bacteria that's gotten into your system, et cetera. So that's an IgG response. That is by far the most common response that I see when people come to me and say, you know, I've got all these gut problems and I've got a rash and I'm getting headaches and migraines, and I think it might be related to wheat. That's almost always an IgG response. Now, the problem with IgG responses is almost everybody has them. Any of you that have taken antibiotics, any of you that have done non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, birth control pills, the odds are you have sensitivities to foods from an IgG basis. Now, the problem is in identifying those, like I'll have patients, I say, I'd like you not to drink dairy and not do wheat for a couple days. And they'll come in and say, I felt fine. You know, I ate wheat last night and dairy, and I feel fine today. Well, the problem is that type of response is delayed, and it takes usually 12 to 72 hours before people notice the problem, right? And it's not a life-threatening problem, at least short-term, so they tend to just kind of, oh, I don't know why I have a headache today. I don't know why my arthritis is acting up. And so that's the trickiest one. A true allergy is an IgE response. That's when you eat a peanut and you go into anaphylactic shock. Everybody knows pretty much when they have that type of allergy. So celiac disease is what MDs are most likely to look for in terms of wheat problems. And there are several good reasons for that. One, it is the one that can kill you. And many children died of celiac disease before they understood that it was a wheat-based problem. It destroys the villi of the intestines. So the small intestine is a tube with little fingers sticking out in it. And those are called villi. And that's to give it more surface area. It's like if you go to one of the, what do they call it? Harbors, where the boats are. If you just had one flat shoreline, you can't put very many boats. But when you put the finger-like projections out there, then you can get lots of boats on them. So the surface area of the small intestine is tremendously large because of these villi. Well, in celiac disease, what happens is the body responds to wheat as an allergen and then creates an autoimmune response. And that autoimmune response, autoimmune meaning immunity, auto. The body misidentifies, right? Because in the body's defense systems, something is either I or not I. If it's I like it. If it's not I kill it. That's the way the immune system basically works. So what happens is the immune system runs amok and it starts to identify your tissue as not I. And so that's an autoimmune response. And it completely wipes out those villi. So you can't absorb minerals. And whenever I see patients say in their 20s or 30s, typically female, and is having bone problems, maybe they break a foot where they wouldn't think that was reasonable, the first thing I check for is celiac disease because they can't absorb calcium, they can't absorb other nutrients, and they get very frail in a variety of ways. Now, this is exciting, isn't it? That's a picture of a small intestine. And which is very complex, by the way. When I teach gastroenterology, we spend hours looking at this. So you can see it's a very complex structure here. And in here, these are the villi that are sticking out into the lumen of the intestines where things get absorbed. Now, if things on the surface of here get broken down, proteins get broken down into smaller pieces called amino acids. Amino acids come here, the body says, ah, this is food. This is great. And it brings it into the body. Into the bloodstream. But if a protein gets in touch with this, like you get a big glob of gluten sitting here, then you get an immune response. And massive, massive numbers of cells will just attack through here. 80% of your immune system is in your gut, right? That's where you're most likely to be attacked at any time, much more so than in your lungs or externally. This is a picture of an actual villi blown up, I think, 10,000 times. And so you can see here the damage that's being done. Now, this actually is a leaky gut problem. And when you hear that term, it's a real, real thing. The gut leaks. So things that should go into your system don't, and things that shouldn't actually do. They pass through these holes in the gut and between the cells, and they actually get into your bloodstream. And that's one of the things that causes the massive amounts of inflammation. So this is an actual picture of a human intestinal villi that's being attacked and has massive inflammation. And so this is a leaky gut patient. So with celiac disease, let's see. Yeah, I'm not going to talk too much about that. It was once that when I first had horrible gut problems, I very nearly died. I was up in Reno. I was a professional poker player. And this is a long time ago, long time ago. And my dad happened to visit, the only time he ever visited. And I'd been having episodes that felt like someone stuck a poker red hot into my gut and twisted it. And these would happen about once a week. And I would literally almost pass out. I would then go into anaphylaxis where I'd get hives and my throat would start to swell. Well, this particular time, it happened in Reno. And my dad just, by the grace of God, happened to be there, drove me to the hospital, and they said 10 more minutes, I would have died. Now, I went to my GI doc. They didn't have as many tests then as they do now, but he tested me with everything that they had. And I went in, and he said, well, John, we're going to do surgery. And I said, oh, great, great, hallelujah. You know, at least you know what's wrong. And he said, well, no, it's exploratory. And I said, you know, I'm going to go back to the little Chinese guy that I saw and do some acupuncture and herbs because the last time I was told I needed surgery by two doctors, he fixed my back and my back's fine. So I won't tell you what the doctor said to me at that point, but I did go back to my Chinese doctor. Now, this is 30, almost 40 years ago, and he gave me herbs, gave me acupuncture, and he said, and don't eat wheat. You stop eating wheat. And about 2 years later, I'd kind of forgotten, like I wanted to forget. And so I ended up going to a Korean Zen monk. And I walked in. First thing he said to me is, oh, you can't eat wheat. Now, he didn't say that to the other people with me, but he said it to me, right? So that was my story. And I'm not going to tell you the cat case because we don't have time, although it is fascinating. Celiac disease, you know, people again think, oh, let me go back here. So when I first developed this problem, I went to my doctor and I said, I think I've got a wheat problem, and he laughed at me. The reason he laughed at me, is that at that time the estimate is that celiac disease affected between 1 in 25 and 1 in 30,000 people. Now, the latest estimate I saw is that it affects 1 out of every 66 people. Now, this is the deadly form of wheat problem, celiac disease. I believe we're going to see that the rate is actually higher than that. Now, one of the things that we had been told is that you were born genetically, you had this problem, and that was it. You would have it from birth, and you'd always have it. Well, that's actually been disproven. There is, of course, a genetic predisposition, as there is with most problems, but they took blood from a group of 50-year-olds, I believe, don't quote me on the age, a group of people, very large group of people, and they checked them for the markers for celiac disease. 10 years later, they took the same group, and a significant number of those people showed up with celiac markers at 60 years old that didn't have them at 50. So this is something that can actually develop at least the illness part of it over time. Aretaeus of Cappadocia is the guy who coined the phrase celiac disease. This is first century AD, so we're looking about 2,000 years ago. Sprue is the term introduced from the Dutch in the 19th century, and then Dr. Samuel G. recognized the importance of diet. He started seeing that people with celiac disease would respond to different diets, but he couldn't quite pin down what it was. And then Sidney Haas had a banana diet, which, guess what they ate a lot of? A lot of bananas. But what they didn't eat was wheat. So he kept them on the banana diet, which saved their lives, not knowing that it was really the wheat that they were eliminating. And then Dr. Willem Carroll Dick discovered that flour was the culprit. And many things were actually discovered like this during World War II, as there were shortages of butter. They found that eating butter prevented heart disease, right? These people started eating margarine, and they started dropping like flies. And flour wasn't available. So they noticed that kids who had been dying at about a 35% rate from celiac disease, that rate dropped to zero. Kids weren't dying anymore. So that's when it was first put together about wheat being at the root of celiac disease. Now, again, this is the most severe type. Very, very nasty things. Now, wheat allergies. This is the one I mentioned. You eat a piece of wheat and you have an allergic response. Pretty much anybody that has this problem knows about it, so I'm going to skip over it. It's not that common. This delayed onset is acquired. The leaky gut makes it much more common. Anytime you eat a food while you have what's actually called leaky gut, intestinal dysbiosis, the odds of becoming allergic or hypersensitive to that food is skyrockets, absolutely skyrockets. And it's the reason why after you take antibiotics, if, you know, unfortunately you need to do that, you need to do massive amount of probiotics, but you also need to not, you need to eat a very simple diet, and it's best if you eat things that you don't like, because you run the risk of developing a sensitivity to those foods that you do like. Okay, because you will have some level of intestinal dysbiosis after any antibiotic use. At the bottom here it says delayed onset, flooded with CICs. CICs are circulating immune complexes. So when that piece of wheat comes in, the antigen that you're allergic to or hypersensitive to, and it gets marked with the immunoglobulin, and then the giant macrophages come along and eat it. After the they're big cells, they eat a lot of these things, 150, 200, and then they die. When they die, they're circulating through your bloodstream. And if you have enough of these, which many people do, the body can't break them down, the liver can't break them down quickly enough, and they get shunted off into different tissues. And this is one of the reasons, it's not the only reason, why people that go on a wheat-free diet often notice tremendous changes in their arthritic problems. Well, yeah, I don't have anywhere else to say this, so I'll say it now. The number one thing that I have found dietarily for treating Hashimoto's thyroiditis or autoimmune thyroiditis, which is skyrocketing, the number one thing I found to be effective is to stop eating wheat. Because I test people, and they will have antibodies up in the 1,500, 2,000 range, which means an autoimmune problem. I get them off wheat, and a few weeks it's down to 200 or 300. It's shocking, shocking the difference. Rheumatoid arthritis, first thing I will do is get people off of wheat, and you'll get a dramatic benefit in most cases, not all, but about 50 to 60%, you'll actually see a difference. So 95% of my patients feel better when they stop eating wheat. You know, there's a big thing about glutinous grains, rye, barley. To me, it looks like wheat is about 20 times more problematic for my patients than barley or wheat. And some people say oats. It depends on how they're grown. So if someone has celiac disease, you shouldn't get near. You shouldn't even walk down the aisle where the bread is, right? No rye, no barley, no wheat. If you just have a wheat problem or a gluten problem, typically you can do a little bit of rye or barley. You also get a problem with the rapid breakdown to sugar, right? Grains turn to sugar very quickly. The worst food for a diabetic for breakfast, well, it's not true. The one that people eat that they think is a good food and is horrible is oatmeal for breakfast. It's the worst thing for a diabetic because you get this rapid release of sugar from the breakdown of the simple carbohydrate, right? So your blood sugar skyrockets, then the insulin chases it and bypasses it, so then you'll get blood sugar lows and you'll get this seesaw effect or this roller coaster effect all day long. That's why I advocate for all my diabetic patients that they eat protein and fat for breakfast. I actually advocate that for all of my patients, but for the diabetic patients, to get them non-diabetic in 4 to 6 months, they have to change that breakfast. That's the single most important meal to do that, because otherwise you've got an entire day of being out of balance. And again, I mentioned I almost died from wheat allergy. I talked about this. This is my hero. This is a fellow named Lee Dong-yen. Lee Dong-yen caused a significant shift in Chinese medicine. Now, in Western biomedicine, there's something new every week, like going off in different directions, new discoveries. In Chinese medicine, that happens about every 100 to 500 years. Okay, not a lot of changes. Well, Lee came along at a time. So before that, China was in a Confucian period. And in Confucianism, you do not question your elders, period. Grandpa's in charge, and then pa, and then, you know, it goes down this lineage. So there was a great Chinese herbalist named Zhang Zhongjing, who in around 220 AD wrote a book called the Shanghanlun. And it became the Bible of Chinese herbalism. And nobody questioned anything in that book until around this time when Neo-Confucianism came in, and it was okay. You still had to pay homage completely, but you could maybe make a little suggestion off the side. So with the Shanghanlun, the theory was that disease was from the exterior, kind of like Pasteur, right? It's hitting you from the outside. I mean, they called it cold strikes, even though it could be heat. And then it worked into the body. Li Dongyan, in 1249, I believe, published a book called The Treatise of the Spleen and Stomach, where he said, yeah, that's all cool. However, our culture has changed. And now the diseases that I treat are internally engendered. It's caused by bad lifestyle, bad eating, bad drinking, because the Chinese now had discovered how to ferment or how to make hard alcohol rather than just beer and wine. In fact, his hangover remedy is still the best hangover remedy on the market. I don't tell patients about it because then they want to go out and drink and just take the herbs, right? In fact, he actually said, I wish I hadn't invented this formula. But he is the one who really turned this around and said, you know, the digestive system is really the core. On every level, because if you can't digest food, You know, it doesn't matter what you take in. It doesn't matter what else you do. And most of these problems are internally engendered. And he was really talking a lot about the things we talk about now in terms of the causes of diabetes, the causes of cardiovascular disease, inflammation, etc. And he nailed it 750 years ago. I mean, dead on. He's still ahead of diabetes practitioners in the U.S. I know because I do both. I do both. I was trained in China in their integrated diabetes protocol, and he gets better results. Okay. I mean, except for acute care. I mean, if you need to go into the hospital, that's different. And so one of his formulas, and I didn't put it here because it was too long, but in the formula, he gives a list of herbs, and he says how to prepare them, you know, how to cut them up, how long to soak them, and what the dosage is, to drink while warm between breakfast and lunch, reduce food, eat only good food, refrain from drinking wine, refrain from talking for 2 to 3 hours, and don't eat wheat. 750, 760 some years ago, don't eat sodden wheat foods. Now, that was at a time when the wheat he was talking about was far more nutritious, far less hybridized, had far less gluten, was far less problematic than the wheat we have now. And he was still saying, yes, now he didn't recommend this for everybody, but for some people, wheat was a problem 750 years ago. Okay, and as we see from the Greek fellow, 2,000 years ago. So this is not a new problem. It's simply become massively more rampant, just as diabetes and cardiovascular disease have topped the charts in terms of illnesses, where 200 years ago they were very, very minor problems, you know, in terms of statistical issues. So what do you eat? I mean, it gets kind of hard, doesn't it? I'm going to show you a picture that one of my patients, who's now in New York, sent me today. So I told her I'd put it in my presentation, so you can thank her. This is her mousse and persimmon. This is mousse. About Chinese dietary theory knows that it is very much color-based and extremely accurate. We now know that the colors that the Chinese recommended eating at different times of year were foods that were more healing at those times of the year. For example, if you're eating persimmons, which are ripe now, persimmons are incredibly, what gives them that color is they're very dense in beta carotenoids and other carotenoids, which are some of the best foods to protect your lungs and your body from the insults that are going to be coming in the winter. So the reason I wanted to bring this picture is that she has included the 5 Chinese colors, right? I don't think she did this on purpose, right? You've got yellow and orange and white and green and red, and I'm going to call that black. That's the kind of the meat is kind of falls into that category. So that's what you eat. How many of you have read or heard Terry Walls speak? Terry Walls is an MD. You can find her on YouTube. And Terry Walls had MS of such severity that she was confined to a wheelchair, that a very special wheelchair. She couldn't do any wheelchair. She had to lay flat. And at home, she was confined to a chair like that. She was a medical doctor. She started doing some research because she realized the treatments she was getting didn't work. Terry Walls, check her out, W-A-H-L-S, completely reversed her MS, multiple sclerosis, with her eating plan. She eats 3 gigantic plates of vegetables a day. And it's very fascinating, her story. So there's what you eat. And then if we had time, we'd go into glyphosates, which is Roundup, right, the herbicide. And herbicide, plants that are not killed by herbicides. And this is changing the entire food industry. And since glyphosates have started to be used, so you saw from 2,000 years ago, you saw this slow increase in celiac disease. And then it went way up after we hybridized the wheat differently. And when glyphosates came in, it skyrocketed. It looks like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth diagram. So if you're interested, Cynthia Seneff, S-E-N-E-F-F, has some very nice interviews online where she talks about how the glyphosate has taken a food that was bad and made it horrific. Okay. So anyway, check it out. Unless you're absolutely determined to keep eating wheat, and then absolutely do not listen to her. Okay, she will freak you out. Yes. Oh, yeah, what should you do? See, the problem is in the United States, one of the problems, in the United States, our food industry is driven by quantity. You know, we have larger quantities of food on our plates than most people in the world do, right? We all know the French eat these very, very rich, delicious foods, you know, and they don't gain weight, and they're very healthy. They have lower disease rates of almost everything except liver cancer because they drink too much. But otherwise, they have lower diseases, incidence of most diseases. Part of that is the French cuisine has not been driven by quantity. It's been driven by quality. So the wheat, so I'll have patients that if they eat wheat, they walk around like this because they're so inflamed. By the way, typically when patients go on a detox type diet where they remove these high lectin foods, the average weight loss in my clinic is about 9 pounds in 2 weeks. Now that's not fat. It wouldn't happen that quickly. This is water that you can finally get rid of because you don't have to hold those fluids to fight the inflammation in your body. And this happens 95% of the time. People will have a very significant weight loss, and it's almost all water weight. So when my patients, my brother just got back from Italy, and he has lots of food sensitivities. He ate everything. He drank the wine. He drank the coffee. He ate the wheat. He ate everything there. Had no problems because they have kept the quality of the food. In France, it is actually the cows that we milk for milk in the United States, primarily the black and white cows, are illegal to milk in France. Right? There was a genetic shift in a beta casein molecule, and the brown and white cows didn't pick that up, and sheep and goats didn't pick it up, but the black and white cows did, and there's a proline molecule that gets inserted, and that milk is basically like an opioid. It's like taking heroin. That's why people get hooked on the milk, but it's incredibly inflammatory. It's a beta casein molecule. So in France, it's illegal to milk those cows. And that the wheat varieties are different, and they're different throughout most of Europe. And I have so many patients that have come here from France, and when I sit down with them and I say, you know, I want to run a test because I think you have a wheat problem, they go, that's not possible. I've been eating it all my life. You were eating wheat, but you weren't eating this wheat. And so if you have celiac disease, you can't eat any wheat. But if you, anywhere in the world, but if it's less than that, if it's a sensitivity, the estimate in Perlmutter's book was that 60% of Americans have pretty significant sensitivities or hypersensitivities to wheat. So that's a pretty high number. I think he's wrong. I think it's higher than that. Yeah. So anyway, sorry for the bad news. So stick to wine and beer. That's why my patients like me. Beer, it does. Barley. Barley gluten is much less damaging than wheat gluten, and you'd have to get a Hefeweizen, right? You'd have to get a wheat beer before you had significant wheat problems. Now, beer actually has some other problems. It is dampness forming in Chinese medicine, and a lot of people don't do well with beer. I do perfectly well with it. Thank you. Yeah. So, questions. Let's do some questions. Yes. I think she's going to bring a...
Wait for the mic to come your way. This way we can record your question. Thank you.
Okay, I don't have wheat problems that I'm aware of, and I don't want them. But what I did is I got online for heritage wheat. Uh-huh. Now, and there is some that I thought about maybe buying them because I do make my bread. I mean, not all of it, but I thought I could do that. Now, would that work?
Well, first you should bring some over and let me taste it, and then I'll tell you if you're going to make homemade bread. So the heritage, and I love the movement that we're seeing toward, you know, in Santa Rosa they have the big show. A lot of my patients go up there. The heritage wheat is complete. The einkorn wheat typically is one of the older varieties. It's a particular structure that I'm not going to go into now that is much less. Now, if someone had celiac disease, but you'd know that if you did, if they had it, then they shouldn't even eat with that. But if you don't have celiac disease, that's a really good choice. You know, I still wouldn't eat too much, right? But that's probably safe for most people. completely different animal. And also, if you were getting it so that it wasn't sprayed with glyphosate and other herbicides, that would be really good too, because it makes a world of difference.
Hi.
You wrote down your question. That's so cool.
Oh, I wrote down everything you said. I wrote it down in the middle because it reminded me that we have a daughter who has Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And at one point, I actually had control over her and took her primary off of almost all wheat, although she snuck some in. Her antibody went down 65% in a month.
Yeah, you hear that? 65% in 1 month, her antibodies went down. Yeah. And what's significant for that is the people that I trust, I teach a lot of these things in doctoral programs, and the people that I trust say that nobody has only one autoimmune disease.
No, so, she has, we know what she has. You're right.
Yeah.
If
you have one, because it's not, it will attack in particular ways, but when the body gets to that point, there are multiple autoimmune problems. And so by lowering that by 65%, you did that for her whole body.
Well, she's going to come and see you, I hope. But okay. I had one other thing I wanted to ask. You talked about rheumatoid arthritis, and her husband has psoriatic arthritis. Uh-huh. Is that also something that can be cured? Or helped significantly.
Cured is always a tough call,
but removing
right?
Removing wheat, is that?
I would remove wheat. In that case, I would see it more like putting gasoline on a fire that's there. The wheat will make everything worse, right? It's going to cause more inflammation. It's probably not going to cure the psoriatic arthritis, but I've seen several patients who have gotten over their psoriatic arthritis.
And really?
Yeah. Oh, sure. In fact, this isn't psoriatic arthritis, but it was a fun thing. You know, people always say, well, what are the side effects of this medicine? And I'll say, usually you're going to feel really good. But I had one guy come in. He's, I don't know, in his 80s, great guy. And he came in for gout and gallstones. And so I treated him. And at the end of the treatment, he was fine. The gout was gone. I said, so did you have anything else going on? He says, well, it was kind of weird. He said, I was in the Navy. I was at Pearl Harbor. And after Pearl Harbor, I developed psoriasis over my whole body. And once I did your herbs a couple times, the psoriasis went away. So anyway, I now use that formula for psoriasis. Yes, please.
I'm interested. There are lots of gluten-free breads and things. Do you have any? Are they okay? I mean, just because they say they're gluten-free, are we safe with them?
The companies that I know of that say they're gluten-free, I believe them. I know people that are involved and or owners like Mariposa Bakery. Now, I hesitate to ever tell my patients about Mariposa Bakery because it's so darn good. And I don't get any money for this, for plugging them. But it's scary because my patients will go over there and eat too much, and it's still a simple carbohydrate, and they gain weight, and it throws their insulin and blood sugars out of balance. But if you're going to do it, that's the place to do it. My son gets very excited when we talk about Mariposa Bakery.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I have Hashimoto's, and I found Mariposa, and it was very much like that. And I baked for many, many years and loved to bake. And I also found cup-for-cup flour, which is a savior. I mean, it's just so wonderful. Actually, my daughter found it and told me about it. And you can use that flour just like any all-purpose flour and bake all of your family's recipes from whenever and enjoy them, and it'll be just the same.
You hear that, honey? We're not big bakers, but I'm working on it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John. That was great.
When I said honey, that's my wife, just so you know. All right.
So what is the difference between a wheat-free and gluten-free diet? Because aren't...
Okay. So gluten is how do we do this in 30 seconds? So there are gliadins and glutenins and a variety of these different protein-type structures. And certain grains have more or less of those in them. And the grains that have the most are wheat, barley, and rye, and then oats sometimes have some. There's some debate about whether it's really in the oats or whether it's from the facilities. But so wheat is by far the most problematic in terms of having gluten or gliadin. So there are gluten and gliadin allergies, sensitivities. So if you eat any of those foods, it would be a problem. There are also wheat-specific sensitivities and allergies. So even if it's gluten-free wheat, if you can get that, I don't think you can, but if you could, you would still have a problem because you'd have a problem to the wheat itself. So that's why it gets so complex. Like I said, with wheat, there are about 28 different ways it can have an effect on your body that's non-beneficial. I have to tell one, let me take some more questions, and then I'll tell you a story.
Can you talk about gluten sensitivity in soy sauce?
Yeah. When I was first diagnosed with my problems, I couldn't even do soy sauce. I found that if I did really, really, really high-quality, long-fermented tamari, it didn't bother me. I then went on to, I'm going to call it cure. You know, these things often go into remission, to cure my wheat problems in myself. So now I can eat wheat, which is probably unfortunate. I don't eat much. And so, but when I was really reactive, soy sauce would throw me, because there, you've got the soy, which is also a high lectin-dense food, as well as the wheat. So you can find wheat-free tamaris, so that's what I would recommend. And the longer they're fermented, the safer they are. With soy, fermentation completely changes it. So miso is one of the healthiest foods on the planet. Eating soy is really bad if it's not fermented. In fact, the Chinese called soy, I believe they call it the king of grains. Well, they called it that because it was the best fertilizer. It has so much nitrogen in it that it'll fertilize everything, but they knew if you ate soy, it would kill you because it's an anti-nutrient. The phytic acid in soy is so high that it blocks the uptake of other minerals. And so they didn't eat it as a food until they learned how to ferment it.
Hi.
Hi.
Those macrophages that eat the foreign bodies,
yeah.
And then they die, and yeah. Then they get distributed around the body somewhere. Uh-huh. Is that interpreted as inflammation?
It will cause inflammation. That process itself is somewhat inflammatory because there's a signaling mechanism that happens, these chemicals called cytokines are released, and those are like the bells on the fire station that pull the trucks in. And so they themselves are inflammatory, and then the activity is also inflammatory. But once the circulating immune complexes are in the bloodstream, that's not so inflammatory, but it does sludge up the works a bit. And then if the liver can't keep up with this process, the theory is, and this is not completely proven, that it then gets shunted out and it leaks, because blood leaks through the blood vessels all the time. It's supposed to. That's how you get nutrients. But in rheumatoid arthritis, there's a theory that that's about half of the problem, is that those waste products get into the tissues. The other problem being that there's an organism in there that's eating the tissue.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. May I ask one more? About long fermentation, I've heard that like from Tartine Bakery does a long fermentation, and that supposedly breaks down some of the proteins in gluten and makes it less inflammatory.
Yeah. Again, it's all a matter of degree. So if I had someone that didn't have a known sensitivity, I'd say eat that once a week if you want, maybe twice a week. If you have a known sensitivity, maybe once a month. If you have celiac disease, I wouldn't trust it. Yeah, thank you.
You said to beware of soy. Would that include edamame, soy milk, and tofu?
Oh, God, my favorite foods. Yes. Yeah, it does. Because the phytic acid content, it's so high. Now, if you eat some edamame once in a while, if you have a little soy milk, it's not a problem. Although in children, should never get near soy milk. Absolutely never. If I were doing a presentation on the evils of soy formula, there's a woman named Khoury, Khoury, who did a study of soy-based formulas. You don't even want to know how deadly they are for children. I think the average increase in death rate was about 9 times versus breastfeeding. It was hideous, horrible. So I would recommend keeping your kids away from soy milk. It's also the genistein content and these other things are estrogenic in nature. So for boys, it would be even more of a problem. You know, for women at menopause, in about 20% of them, I'll say go ahead and have some soy, because it will help a little bit, but I would be very careful, you know, that they don't have a soy problem. Yeah?
I have a question.
Okay. Why, hi.
How can I get that hangover recipe?
If you email me, I'll send you the recipe. It's, it's a very good recipe. One last story. So, do we have time?
Please.
Okay, so this is my wife over here. And I do a couple of three radio shows I was doing, now two. One's a call-in show, which is really fun. So if you didn't get your questions answered, there's a thing on your chair, call me on Friday morning. And I love it because people call in from all over the world. It's Natasha, what's her name? From Moscow? Yeah, it's very fun. So anyway, so one day I came home from doing the radio show, and my wife said, I can't believe it, you were right. Now, of course, I had the pull-down menu. Of course I was right, but being a good husband, I said, about what, honey? And she said, three times in the last few weeks, people called in with totally different illnesses, and one of the things you told them was to stop eating wheat. She said, so I stopped eating wheat. 2 weeks, the pain that I've had deep, deep in my hip, almost crippling pain for how long? 30 years? 20? Since she was 18. So 10 years. So for a while, she said it went away, completely went away. So, of course, she wanted to do a scientific study, so she ate a pizza. Guess what? Pain came back immediately. Went another couple weeks without wheat, pain went away. She had to repeat the scientific study 3 times. But now she's an absolute believer. She will not get near wheat for anything. Wow. Any other questions? Oh, okay. Do we have time, Sylvie?
Please do, yes.
Okay. We need a mic. Oh, where? Here, I'll get it.
So I've got celiac disease, but I also have lots of friends with gluten sensitivities. And some people believe that there are different things that you can take, like you thought you were having a gluten-free bread, it wasn't gluten-free, or cross-contamination. Some people believe that there are different things that you can take afterwards to help sort of flush everything out of your system. Do you have any recommendations around that?
I have a few hundred. One is things to do beforehand, right? So the faster you can get that protein molecule away from the lining of the intestine, the less damage it's going to do. So the first thing would be to dose yourself with high-quality enzymes before you eat the wheat. That way, it's going to break down faster. It'll break down in your stomach and the top of the small intestine, and so it won't get as far down as an intact protein. So that'd be one. High-quality probiotics, obviously, because that's going to shield it. Then there are quite a few products. There's something called Epicor. Again, I don't like to push companies, but I have a product called Pure Defense with NAC, which is N-acetylcysteine, which is also helpful. But the Epicor, so one of those immune modulators that I talked about, immunoglobulins, is IgA. And IgA is really critical to this whole process because IgA is one of the things that protects, it's one of the 12 layers of protection to your gut from these problems. And IgA is a chemical that's released every few cells in the small intestine, and it actually binds with the antigens and carries them out of your system. Most people with severe sensitivities and certainly with celiac disease don't have that function because it's elective. So if your body is under massive stress, that is a process that it won't do. It's elective, right? So most people with sensitivities and certainly celiac disease, their gut is under tremendous stress. They stop producing secretory IgA. Some of the very powerful Chinese formulas that we use for gut health, one of the things they do is they're massive stimulators of IgA production. Huangqi, one of our major formula herbs, is a brilliant herb for microcirculation and stimulates IgA production. The product Epicor is a type of a yeast extract, and that has the fastest increase in IgA production that I've seen. So I would start with those things, and then, of course, anything else you can do to wash things through quickly. All right. Did that answer? Okay, cool. Yes?
I wanted to tell you that that my husband and I went off of gluten things about, was it 2.5 years ago now? I wasn't a gluten intolerant. He was. He wouldn't go off of it, so I just removed it from the house.
Yes, that's the best thing.
And both of us, within 2 months, lost all of our outside allergies completely.
So gone. I hope you heard that, because this is my experience. Because these things are cumulative. You know, I have people with horrible inhalant allergies to dander, mites and stuff, but when you remove everything else that is, because it's additive, right? It's this combination of effects. And when you get rid of those, and then there's some mast cell binders that you can do also, often the allergy problem disappears or becomes 5 to 10% of what it was before. So nice job.
Kind of a testimonial. It took me years of doctors to figure out what was wrong with my stomach. And I've been gluten-free for, I don't know, several years since it became a kind of a quote-unquote fad. Mm-hmm. But I get together monthly with a group of women I went from kindergarten to high school with, and we're all in 72. They talk about their aches and pains. I have none.
Yeah.
And I mean, I do a lot of walking. I do everything. I don't have any arthritic finger joint pain problems at all. And I remember probably 20 years watching one of the programs on television, a History Channel or something like that. And they talked about it was the when they dig up corpses from centuries ago, ancient corpses, there was no sign of arthritis in them.
It depends on the culture, right?
They found that the including of wheat in the diet, and that was long before anybody, I mean, we're talking, that's 20 or 30 years ago, and that program really stuck in my mind.
Yes.
And so I'm really, I wouldn't eat wheat if you put a gun to my head. It's just very...
Yeah, the cultures that were wheat-based, and wheat basically came into prominence about 10,000 years ago. Those wheat-based cultures were smaller in stature, and they had far more chronic disease. When they looked at the more paleo-type diets, which is the popular term now, they had far fewer chronic illnesses, and they had much larger stature also. So. Okay, I think we're at the end, yeah?
If there's no more question, then I think we need to thank Dr. John Leaders for his insightful and informative comments tonight.
Thank you.
And we also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.